Okay, it's December 16th. Yes, I'll be speaking next week, but it's not like these classes, which are really open-ended, and if we do it in 5 or 6 or 7, it doesn't really matter. Those I actually can speak within a limited space of time. You give me 40 minutes or so, I can do that, which I will do it. But I thought of doing something next week on NITL, but then looking at the time, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to stick to the topic I've chosen. So I'll share it with you now because I won't be here next week. And that's because last week, it's just I was someone made a comment. You probably all heard this. It's become like a joke, a running joke, that if we had a halacha to do a Christmas tree, then you'd have all the different halachas, how tall it has to be, can it be artificial, does it have to be real, all these things. And it's a big joke. So the person said that, I didn't say anything, but I want to tell you, Rav Soloveitchik actually dealt with this. Last year, Tradition Journal published a transcript. Well, it was notes that Rabbi Yaakov Hamnick, who was in his shiur in the 40s, in his Bernard Revel classes, whole transcript of the Rav's ideas on halacha, and it's called like so, Concepts in Halacha or something like that. And I want to show you the page. Here it is. This is from his writing. Let's see. Hold on. Here it is. Yes, so he's talking about the halachic approach. This is page 28. He says, we have the dalad meaning. That is, we, lahavdil, that is, if we, lahavdil, had a mitzvah of a Christmas tree, there would be a maseches dealing with it. What is the hachalos? Is it a mitzvah of netilah, of hanacha, of
No,
hakafa?
damn it.
What are its measurements? What are the psulim? Does it require a hiddur? So, I mean, here, the Rav himself raised this question, and his point was that the non-Jews, they don't have that. For them, it's just it's a nice thing they do, for their religion. But for us, the idea of having we don't just have nice things. Everything we have also has to include halacha involved with it, because that's what makes it part of our system. We don't just do stam things like that. Religious rituals, the Rav was very opposed to, just this sort of, rituals which don't have any halachic basis. So next time you hear someone say that joke, you can say, well, it might be a joke, but Rav Soloveitchik used it really to show a difference between how Judaism deals with our holidays and how other religions. Okay. Thank you, Baruch. For, I mentioned last class for my Moliver that he shows how important Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is by pointing out that we allow a Torah prohibition to be violated. A non-Jew writes up a contract to buy land in Eretz Yisrael for us, and we don't allow that for Bris Milah, which is it's a chayav kares if you don't give your child a circumcision. So Baruch points out, I knew this, but I forgot, but thank you for reminding me, Baruch, that if you actually look in the Ramah, because the Gemara says that you can have them do this, write the contract up. The Ramah says in Shin Vav, Yud Aleph, that he says that you can have the non-Jews do use their non-Jewish script to write up, let's say, such a document. Why? Because this is only rabbinic. He says that it's only rabbinic prohibition writing. That is, if you write in English or in Latin or whatever it is, it's only rabbinic prohibition. And therefore, you can have the non-Jew do it. Now, if you look at the Mishnah Berurah quite interestingly says that this is the Or Zeruah's opinion. But then he says, he explains in the Be'er Halacha, listen to this, that the Or Zeruah is a das yechidahi, ve'ein la shum makom b'shas, v'chol ha'poskim cholik, cholkin al zeh, v'sfir olay da'af b'chsav sholhem u'isidur ha'isa, v'chol ha'shom. So the Mishnah Berurah, very strong language. I'm not such an expert in the Mishnah Berurah. I don't know if he ever uses such strong language about a Rishon like this, but he says that the Or Zeruah's argument that this is only his idea, that this is only rabbinic, is rejected by everyone. It has no source, and that writing in any language is an issur d'oraisa. And therefore, Rav Moliver's point, you know, it's interesting that he just ignores the Ramah, but the standard view, despite what the Ramah says, is that it's a d'oraisa malacha it's a d'oraisa prohibition, I should say, to write in any language. I mean, do you have to do a whole letter? No, but the point is to write a document would be a d'oraisa. So Rav Moliver's point remains. Baruch also, thank you, Baruch. Those who want to follow up on this whole idea of the kalim, if the rabbis make a gezerah, if not a gezerah, if the local Rav says that only this shochet is valid and someone else also shechts, there's a long tshuva, I shouldn't say long, a short tshuva, by the Noda Behuda's son in Noda Behuda Marduah Tanyana Yordea number 48, which he also goes, so he goes, what about after the fact? And he doesn't think it should be a problem, but then he thinks maybe it should be a problem. And he goes back and forth. Really, in the end, he concludes that it's best to wait for a day afterwards, let it go 24 hours, and then you don't have any problems. But he is inclined to assume that if, as he says, if the rabbi only makes a decree for the kavod of, let's say, the shochet or something like that, then we don't assume that it's after the fact that the kli is made treif. So it's interesting tshuva. I could go through it because he makes a lot of interesting points, but in the interest of time, I'm not going to. And finally, this is where we left off. This whole issue of, there's so much I could say about the idea of living in Eretz Yisrael. We'll see some more of it today. I mean, you have all sorts of very interesting texts. You have, there's Afan Hasid Sherebi that says you can't really be only a complete tzaddik can live in Eretz Yisrael. And you have many interesting passages like that. But I said, I couldn't remember, and I said that the Rambam, I think, is a little different than the Gemara. And indeed, I remembered correctly. The Gemara says that if you don't live in Eretz Yisrael, it's as if you worship idols. So what does the Rambam say? The Rambam says, and this is in Malachim, chapter 5, Halacha Yabez, La'olam yidur adam Eretz Yisrael. Everyone should live in Eretz Yisrael, even in a city that's majority non-Jews. And don't live in Chutzar, it's even a city majority Jews. But he doesn't add that expression that we saw from the Gemara, that anyone, if you live in Eretz Yisrael, it's as if you have a God, no matter what your sins are, I guess. And if you live in Chutzar, it's Dome, it's as if you don't have God. He doesn't say that. He leaves that out, which is interesting. Furthermore, he says that the Gemara says, whoever lives in Chutz Haaretz, it's as if you doma kamisha ein lo eloah. What does the Rambam say? He says, kol hayotze l'chutz haaretz ke'il oved avodah zarah. If you go to Chutz Haaretz. So the implication is that if you're born in Chutz Haaretz, then you don't have the problems here. Actually, the Rambam, the Tosefta says, the Tosefta says this. The Rambam adopts that. But the implication of this here is that the Rambam, he's not recording the other position, that if you live in Chutz Haaretz, that's from Maseches Ksubos, it's as if you're at that status. Only if you leave Eretz Yisrael and you go to Chutz Haaretz, then it's as if you worship idolatry. But if you're born in Chutz Haaretz, you don't have that category anymore. And this could tie into the Rambam, what he says, that it's an Isser to leave Chutz Haaretz. He doesn't say, basically, the Rambam does not say that if you live in Eretz Yisrael, you have this special spiritual status, like we see in the Gemara and Kasubos, that if you live in Eretz Yisrael, domet, that you have... even if you live in a city of non-Jews, it's Doma that you have a God. And if you live in Chutzar, it's not. Why does the Rambam, it's unusual, why does the Rambam ignore the Gemara and Kasubos and go with the Tosefta's formulation? It's something I'm looking right now in Reb Nachum Rabinovich's Peirush, and he mentions this and he deals with it, but he doesn't really give an explanation, like a philosophical explanation, why the Rambam chose to go with the Tosefta's formulation. So needs further investigation. Now, something before we pick up here. Something I thought about after the class, I didn't mention. Rav Moliver, it came to me. I thought of it, and it's an important point, so let me mention it. Rav Moliver is citing and speaking about the importance of Eretz Yisrael. He's citing all these biblical sources, including sources. Avraham is told to go to the land of Israel. Yitzchak, he doesn't leave Eretz Yisrael. I mean, we have all these Torah sources from Sefer Bereishis that speak about Eretz Yisrael. The whole basis goes back to God says to Abraham, leave this land, go to the land I'm going to give you. Everywhere you step, it's going to be for your descendants, all these things. So some of you might know about the principle that the Rambam mentions. It's found in the Yerushalmi. It's in Moed Katan. As far as I know, I don't remember if it's in the Bavli, but the Rambam mentions it in Parashat Mishnah. We know we don't learn anything from before Matan Torah. That's a principle, right? So we don't, it says in the Yerushalmi, lomdim mikodem matan Torah. With matan Torah, then we're given a Torah and everything's applicable. So I was thinking that maybe, you could challenge, people might think you could challenge Rav Moliver. He's citing all these things from before matan Torah. Kedushas Eretz Yisrael, does that have any halachic validity before matan Torah? All these sorts of things. But, then I recalled that there's actually a Maariv Chayis, Ritzihir Chayis, in his commentary on Chulin. I think I wrote down six Tes Zayin Amud Aleph, and I think also later as well. But he says as follows, and I think this is not controversial. I think everyone assumes this, that the only time we say we don't learn from before Matan Torah, that's Dovar Shehu Chovos Hadin. That's talking about halacha. All the different halachas. That's what the Rambam says. That is, everything before Matan Torah has to be reaffirmed after. So you tell me that you don't eat the hindquarters. It's not because of any story with Yaakov. I mean, that's where it began. But it has, if it's not reaffirmed in the Torah, then it's not binding. Bris Milah, all these things need to then be affirmed as part of Mosaic revelation. However, Maariv Chayis says, when dealing with something, shehu chavivus ha-mitzvah, when you're dealing with something that, is not halacha per se, but, love of a mitzvah or something, all these larger characteristics and Eretz Yisrael, the importance, leaving aside the purely halachic element of it, because even those who don't hold it, everyone agrees, even if you don't hold this as an actual mitzvah, you share Eretz Yisrael, the importance of Eretz Yisrael in so many other ways, everyone agrees with that. So that is still applicable. Now, Maariv Chayis doesn't mention Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. That's what I'm saying. We see all the descriptions of Eretz Yisrael before Matan Torah. Maariv Chayis mentions another example. Vayashkem Avraham Baboker. Where do we learn from that? Zrizim Nakdim Mitzvos, that you're supposed to be Zari, supposed to be zealous in doing the Mitzvos, because Avraham gets up in the morning to do it as soon as he can. He doesn't wait till the afternoon. So you could say, well, how can we learn that? It's before Matan Torah. The answer is because it's not halacha. It's more of an overarching approach to how we should relate to Torah and to mitzvos, and that we do learn, Maariv Chayis says, from before Matan Torah. So I think you could say, you make the same assumption about Eretz Yisrael, its value, and so many other things. We ended off, I was in the middle of reading to you the important points in Rav Moliver's letter, in which he explains why he went to Eretz Yisrael and what he saw there. So I want to pick up with that right where we left off. If you recall, Rav Moliver derived something very interesting that it says, rather live in Eretz Yisrael, even in a place where they're all evil, all idolaters. And he reads this as, wrote Selamar, even if you go there and you're going to lose Torah, it's still worth it to go there. I raised the question, does this mean, if you know 100%, but I guess no one's ever going to know 100%. But the idea is that even if there's a good chance you will lose it, and even if in the end you do end up giving up Torah, it's still worth it and to have gone there, and better to, you can't do this chalila, but b'diavad, and that's a very radical statement. I mean, he cites the Hafla. He derives it from it. The Hafla doesn't actually say that, to go that far. The Hafla says, one who lives in Eretz Yisrael, even though he threw off Torah, since he has a mitzvah yishuv Eretz Yisrael, he's like someone who has a, he has God. But that's the pshat, not the idea that where he goes even further, that by, well, maybe it is, that's what the Foss says, that anyone who lives in Eretz Yisrael, even if you threw off the yoke of Torah, since you have Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, it's as if, you know, you have a Kodesh Baruch Hu. So that's, he says, even if by going to Eretz Yisrael, you throw it off. So actually, I take that back. It seems to be the what the flaw is saying. Okay, so then let's pick up. And then he said, so the Ramolifer says, you know, with the great importance of Eretz Yisrael that we see, he says, I'm astounded that you have great Rabbonim and leaders of Torah and Hasidut, he says, who are opposed to living in Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. He doesn't understand. And he says that... this is what we ended with last class, that everyone has to acknowledge. I don't know if everyone has to acknowledge, but he says that no one is getting worse in the land of Israel. He says anyone who's a sinner in Israel, they'd be worse in Chutz Aretz. And then he continues. He says, I was in Eretz Yisrael. I visited Rov HaColoniot, most of the colonies. He says, almost all of them. He says, and I say with complete certainty that everything that people have so lashon hara about them, that they're irreligious, etc., it's all sheker, he says. He says, you find among the colonists those who are tzaddikim be'emes, because they live in Eretz Yisrael and they're working the land. He says, they're benefiting miyagia kapam, that is, with their hands, they're working the land. Beli onah v'tarmis, without thievery. I think this is a reflection of the fact that many people, including Rav Molliver, assume that when you're a merchant, the inclination is to engage in thievery. You know, cheat someone here or there, goyim, non-Jews, goyim, it doesn't matter. You know, they had this idea that working the land, you're removing yourself from these jobs that we were forced into that we didn't want. And he says there was also beinonim b'kiyum Torah mitzvos. He says there are people who are not the most pious. They're in the middle. He says, but they're just like our beinonim here in Europe. But he says they have three milos, he says, three areas are superior to our beinonim. They live in the land of Israel. They're involved in building up the land of Israel, and they observe the mitzvos hatzuyos b'aretz. And he says, yes, let's say you'll find some people who are like real sinners in Eretz Yisrael. He says, that's like you find everywhere. That's nature, the teva. You're always going to have people like that. But there he says they're miyuta b'demiyuta. And he says, we do not find there like we find here people who are Machal Shabbos publicly. At least he didn't see that. Then he continues. And he says, we already mentioned about the Ramban's view of living in Eretz Yisrael and how it's not just living there. You have to be involved in working the land. We don't need to repeat that. He talks about planting fruits and things like that. And then he says, those of them who moved to Eretz Yisrael, Ashreichem. You know, he says, speaking to them, you know, you are what you're going to see. He says, Olamchem tiru b'chayechem. You see your life, you know, your spiritual attainments in your lifetime. He says, you're freed from mischar. Asher hayitem asurim lo behevle shav. He says, you don't have to be a merchant. You don't have to be, you know, all these things that Jews were involved with, which he's sort of adopting the critique that these professions created bad characteristics for the Jews. He says they're full of thievery. And You constantly are worried you're going to go bankrupt. He says, now you have land. You can work with your hands. Very nice. And then he summarizes it. He says, why did I go to Eretz Yisrael? He says, I went there, one, to see if you can live, support yourself from the land. If you can be a farmer, basically, and you can grow, he says, to Einim, Zaysim, Rimonim, Etrogim, etc., etc. Then he says, two, how much money does a family need to make in order to survive there? Three, can we still purchase land in Eretz Yisrael if we're able to send more Jews there? Will the government allow us to purchase more? Four, where is the best land in Eretz Yisrael? What's the prices? Five, will the Turkish government look kindly on Russian Jews coming to live there? So, you know, the Turkey and Russia didn't always get along. Are they going to, the Ottoman Empire, are they going to look kindly about it? Six, how are the settlements today? How are they doing? Then he says seven, Baron Rothschild settlements, how are they doing? And he goes on a couple more things. And then he gives answers to these questions. I just want to call your attention to a few of his answers, because I've said some of them already. He says, in terms of what the best land is, he says the best land is the land Aver HaYarden. Now, Aver HaYarden, when he's speaking, it's not like when Moshe Rabbeinu, you know, it's not like Aver HaYarden meaning, well, it depends where you are, I guess you could say. Look at the beginning of Devarim, what Ibn Ezra has to say about Aver HaYarden. But Aver HaYarden means, he's talking about the land on the opposite side of the Jordan, where the country of Jordan is now. That's what he's speaking about. But he says that that's what he's speaking about. He says, but living there is the most dangerous because the Bedouins there, he says, are very violent. And you can't live there. So there, but he says, we also have good land by the Kinneret, by Tiberia. You know what? I'm not sure now. Remember, originally, the Jews were supposed to be settling the Balfour Declaration on both sides. This is before the Balfour Declaration. I take that back. Now, I think he means along the Jordan, not on the other side of the Jordan. I think he just means that land, what we would call Yehuda Shomron. I don't think he means up. That's what I think he means, because that's what. That's what Aver HaYarden means. It doesn't mean, Aver HaYarden does not mean the opposite side of the Jordan. That's the Ibn Ezra finds the whole, what he thinks the anachronism, that if the beginning of Devarim, here, let me show you, hold on, let me pull up Devarim here. This is one of the controversial passages of Ibn Ezra. Let me share it with you. Here, look in the beginning of Dvarim. It says, Eloh Dvarim, these are the words, Asher Dibar Moshe Kol Yisrael Be'Eiv HaYarden, which Moshe spoke. No, I take that back. So here it's referring to opposite the other side of the Jordan. So I guess that's what Ramolivar is referring to. Over. But see, Ibn Ezra says is he thinks this is anachronistic, because if this was written by Moshe, then it wouldn't say Aver HaYarden, because Aver HaYarden is only from the standpoint of those who have already crossed the Jordan and are in Eretz Yisrael. They will say Aver HaYarden. That is, Moshe, it would have to be another Navi writing it, because Moshe is on the opposite side of the Jordan. But Moshe, he couldn't write this because he is on the opposite side of Jordan. So from Moshe's standpoint, Aver HaYarden would be not on the right side, the eastern side. It would be on the western side, Eretz Yisrael. So if you look in Ibn Ezra, this is one of the secrets of Ibn Ezra, where he alludes to post-Mosaic additions to the Torah, because how could you say, if Moshe's writing this, then he wouldn't say Aver HaYarden. That's what Ibn Ezra says. Obviously, others would disagree and says that no, Moshe's writing it for with the Eretz Yisrael standpoint in mind. So that's why it says Eir HaYarden. So I assume, therefore, when he says Eir HaYarden, he means opposite of Jordan, what I originally said. So he's saying that maybe we could buy land opposite the Jordan and settle there. There, I don't know, actually, where it, as far as I know, no Jews ever settled in Transjordan. No colonists ever said. If you look at the maps, the revisionist map, it was all of, you know, the Balfour Declaration included what was later called Transjordan and Jordan today. That was on the map. And some of that we know where certain of the 2.5 tribes were. But he says it's too dangerous there. We can't go there. And then he's writing this to the Jews in Russia, the Chovei Tzion. And anyone who wants to read his letter, he says, I can't withhold from saying something to my entire people. Have we ever seen Etzba Elohim, the Chol Asher Karanu? Have we ever seen the finger of God in such a way? He says he says it's been 10 years when things have been going bad in Russia, or in Europe, actually, he says, not just Russia. He says all the anti-Semites. And he says as soon as things became bad in Europe, really bad, we know with the 1880s, the pogroms, but he doesn't just say, he says, Berov Medinot Europa, in most of Europe. He says at the very time that things became so bad, what happened? He says, all of a sudden now, God opens up another avenue for us. The light comes. The light comes for us. And the Kol Kore, the voice announces, Shuvu banim uvochem. So as soon as anti-Semitism became really bad and all the persecution, now when one door closes, another door opens. God is giving us the opportunity now, the chance to go to Eretz Yisrael. He says, throw away Elile, you know, your gods of silver and gods of gold, and come dwell in the land of your fathers. So that to him is a providence. That why didn't it happen 20 years before? It happened when the time was right, when Jews are being shown that times are bad for you in the Galut. Some people would say that we're being shown that right now as well, that times are not good for us. And Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook and others wrote about how in the 20s and 30s, God was showing us also, but people didn't listen. And he says to them, my brothers, look carefully. He says, 6 years ago, no one would have believed, no one who had a Secha Bariv Yashar would have believed, that is with a clear intellect, that in such a short time, this dream could become reality, that we could have settlements, we could have Jews living in Eretz Yisrael. He says, Ata zachinu liros befoel, we see it with our own eyes. It's taking place. He says, is this all coincidence? Is this all by accident? Is there anyone who can say that God's hand was not in this? Can anyone deny this? And so he sees Hashkacha Pratis, God controlling everything. And then he says, listen to this. This is interesting. Yeah. You know, Rabbi Kelman last week mentioned that, you know, we're seeing amazing things going on with Syria, etc. So here's our commitment to you. As soon as when Iran falls, as soon as it's safe, I will go there and we will plan our Torah in Motion trip to Iran. As soon as Syria is safe, which I find it hard to believe will ever be safe, because whatever the government is, you have all these jihadis, but Iran might be safe. So in other words, the idea that we'll never be able to go to these places again, we hope that's not the case. And if we can go, Torah in Motion will take you. But I mention that because at the end, Rav Moliver says as follows, because yes, you know, we want to go to Eretz Yisrael, but it's not so clear we'll be able to settle everyone in Eretz Yisrael, and it could take time. He comes up with another solution. He says, when I was passing through Beirut, you know, that's how he got there. He took a boat, I guess, to Beirut, and then it came down. He says, when I was passing through Beirut, Asher Basuria, when I was passing through Beirut, which is in Syria. Remember, this whole Lebanon is just a Syria also, the borders. These are all the French colonial borders. I mean, the whole thing is they should really actually chop Syria up. Zev Farber had a piece the other day in the Times of Israel, you know, that why are these borders sacrosanct? Give the Alawites their old territory that was by the water. Give the Druze their territory. I mean, who chop up this country, which is an artificial country. Lebanon itself is an artificial country from the early 20th century. It used to be regarded as part of Great Assyria. And then they carved it up and created Lebanon. Okay, so he says, as I was passing through Syria, here I saw, and by the way, at that time, Beirut in Syria, Beirut in those days had a very nice Jewish community, both Sephardic and Ashkenazic. In fact, the Rav of the Ashkenazic community, well, I don't know this time in the 1890, but by the early 20th century, had a community. In fact, the Rav of the Ashkenazic community, his name was Ben Zion Lichtman. And he wrote a number of Sfarim, a real Talmud Chacham. And of course, you had Sephardic Rabbanim there as well. He says it's a big city with a lot of merchants in Beirut. And he says surrounding it, there's farmland and vineyards. And he says we should make a Yishuv Gadol there and support it there. And they could be involved in all sorts of things. So in other words, it's important to leave Russia. If we can get everyone to Eretz Yisrael, that's the best. If we can't get everyone to Eretz Yisrael, at least we'll leave Russia. We'll put them into Beirut and Lebanon area. They're close to Eretz Yisrael. They can support Eretz Yisrael, and then they can move. When time is right, they can move to Eretz Yisrael. And don't forget that in southern Lebanon, that's part of biblical Israel also. So you'll be able to move down there. So, but that's his suggestion in terms of getting people out of Europe. You can't get them all to Israel. You know, we could put them into Lebanon. And things will be good there. so much in his letter. And, you know, we already mentioned that early in his life, he didn't think that the irreligious should settle the land. But now we see that he thinks, no, that everyone, including the irreligious, should settle there. And better to be an irreligious person in the land of Israel is a lot better than an irreligious person in Russia, because irreligious in the land of Israel, doma kamishi yesh alayla. It's as if you have, at least you're religious in that sense of living in Eretz Yisrael. Salmon, Yosef Salmon, in his book about orthodoxy and the grips of nationalism, he thinks that this report is one of the most interesting documents in the history of religious Zionism. He says this on page 149, and he continues on 150, and he's right. It's basically it's a programmatic statement which sets forth the bases of religious Zionism in a practical sense, as well as in a theoretical sense. And it's a justification for you know, Aliyah for everyone at this present moment. Needless to say, the words of Rav Moliver and the Gedolim in Lithuania who were pushing this were not accepted by all. I'm going to show you a book. It's called Tikkun Olam. It's actually a later book. It was published, but it published in 1936, I believe, in Munkach. Yeah, 1936, it says. And it's on the title page. It says this book is Neged Shitas HaMishachim, against the reformers. Who are the reformers? Hatzionim, the Zionists, Mizrachim, the Mizrahi, Agudim, means the Agudist Israel, Yishuvistin, that is those who want to establish Yishuvim, V'chol HaMisaf Mehem, the Aretz and Chutzaretz, and everyone who arises out from that. So this is a book of letters against the whole concept of settling in the land. And it's mostly against Mizrahi, Aguda, but it also has earlier letters. So it goes back, it has some earlier letters, it even has a letter responding to Ramolover, so that's why I want to read it to you. But this is a fascinating book. It has the table of contents. It's mostly Hungarian rabbis, anti-Zionists, writing, let's say, in the 20s and 30s, but it has others. It has the Avnei Nezers in here. It has the Rugachever. It also has on... It has the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Rayatz. Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, big anti-Zionist. In fact, Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, the Rayatz, develops the whole idea here that the Jews living in Eretz Yisrael, they're designed, they're a holy settlement. As far as he was concerned, we should all support them. And he speaks very much against business and industry and anything there. He says that's not the what we should be doing there. All we should be, he says, you can have factories in Britain and other places, but no, he says. And he said, what does he say? He says, Chalila, he says, to establish Beit Harosha to Beit Avoda in Yerushalayim, Ir HaKodesh. Jerusalem should just be for holy things and nothing of what we would call, building up the land. He says as follows. He says that the people who live in Eretz Yisrael today, he's speaking about the Ashkenazi and the Sephardim worked. He says they didn't impurify the land with all, physical things, Chomer, Bate Mischar. He says, no, they kept the land holy. And so that's his idea that, in fact, he says, where is it? He says it's something amazing here. Did he say it or is the other? I think it's. Oh no, sorry. It's the next one I want to show you. Oh yeah, okay. So who else is in this? You know who's in this? Rav Teichtal, the Aim Habanim Smecha. I plan on continuing these classes. When I finish with this, we're going to do in a few classes, maybe four or three. We're going to do the Langer case, and then we're going to do Shimon Shkat. Maybe after that, I'll do Rav Teichtal. Do you know Rav Teichtal? Yisachar Shlomo or Yisachar, they probably pronounce it Teichtal, the Aim Habanim Smecha, who becomes a big lover of Eretz Yisrael in the war. His book is published in 1943 in Budapest. But before that, he's one of the leading anti-Zionists. And he has a letter in here. He says, it's amazing what a turn he did. He says, Kol ma'aseh pula, every physical, enoshiot, every physical action that is to build up the land, Lo yoil meuma, haramas karen seal of Yerushalayim. He says, we cannot do anything to build up the land. Anything we do is no good. We have to wait for God to do this. He will bring us back to the land of Israel. And in the Aim Habanim Smecha, he's actually rejecting this point and says, this is our great sin. This is why there's a Holocaust, because we didn't listen to God. He gave us he opened up the land of Israel, wanted us to all come, and we didn't return. So it's an amazing turnaround. But why am I mentioning this book? You could have, if we were doing a history of Zionism and Torah responses, we'd focus on it. But because letter 98 is not from the 20th century, it's not from the 20s and 30s, it's from 1897. And the author of it is the Rav Yecheskel Shraga Halberstam of the Tzanz, the Shinava Rebbe, very important Hasidic Rebbe. And in this letter, he has a direct attack against what we just saw from Rav Moliver. He doesn't mention him by name, but you'll see he's attacking him. He attacks the author, but in a negative way, refers to him, the Chover, the author, in Shivat Zion, who tries to quote the Hafla. I mentioned Hafla, and he says he misinterprets the Hafla. The Hafla doesn't mean what he says. He doesn't explain what the Hafla means. He says, well, what does he try to say? That, that it's better these irreligious Jews should live in Eretz Yisrael. And he says, no, on the contrary. He says, we say that anyone who's a sinner, Tov Yoter Sheyadurs Bechutz Laaretz, he should say in Chutz Laaretz. Why? He says Eretz Yisrael can't tolerate these Rashaim. And then he goes further. And he says something about Rav Moliver that Rav Moliver never says. It's a libel, with all due respect to the Shinava Rebbe. But, you know, if he could say this against, if he could say that Rav Moliver is so wrong and is so in error, I think I can say about the Shinava, he's wrong, because what he says is not true. He says that Rav Moliver, par piv, that's like a negative way of saying, you know, he spoke very improperly. Sheba Eretz Yisrael, Mutar lifrok ol haTorah. Then he says his tipak rucho. But that's not what he says. He quotes Rav Oliver as saying that when you go to Eretz Yisrael, it's permitted to throw off the yoke of the Torah and become a secular, to fry out, to use the normal term expression, because you're living in the land of Israel. If you're living in the land of Israel, you're holy. Rav Oliver never says that. Rav Oliver never says it's permitted to throw off the Torah. What he says is that people, it's better to live in Eretz Yisrael, even if you don't observe Torah, than to live in Chutz Haaretz if you do observe Torah, which itself is radical enough. But of course you have to observe Torah even in Eretz Yisrael. But if unfortunately someone throws it off, he still is in a better place, because the Gemara says don't let, you know, that he has a god. You know, that's radical enough. I think, you know, if the Shinever would attack that, fine. But to say that he says it's mutter to throw off Torah in Eretz Yisrael, Chas v'Shalom, he never says that. And what is Rosh Shinever says? He says, we're not involved in any of this stuff. No settlements. You know when we're going to Eretz Yisrael? He says, we're going to go to Eretz Yisrael when God will save us and gather us. And then, what is he quotes this pasuk. You know, Rav Moaver is talking about go to Eretz Yisrael, and you have fields and you do work there. And what does the Shinever say? No. What's going to happen when God brings us back to Eretz Yisrael? He cites this pasuk from Yeshaya in Perek Samach Aleph 61:5. What does the pasuk say? In messianic vision. And strangers shall stand and feed your flocks, and aliens shall be your plowmen and your vine dressers, and you will be named priests of the Lord. Okay, so in other words, the real bracha will be that one day we'll live in Eretz Yisrael, but then we'll have non-Jews, the Goyim, that's going to be their job to do all these things for us. That's what he says. God will bring us there. And then he says this pasuk, he quotes that they'll yavdu es adam avureinu. They're going to do it all for us. But today he says now, ain shum tova, there's no value that we should go there lavodas adama, to work the land. Because I mean, this is an amazing thing here. I mean, normally you think about working the land, mitzvah sotuyas v'aretz. No, his conception is we'll own the land. So obviously we'll have to follow. It'll be our land, so we'll have to follow mitzvah sotuyas v'aretz. But we're not going to actually go out there and get our hands dirty. That's not what good yidden do. That's for the goyim to do. We will sit and learn Torah. And so it's just a different conception of the Messianic era. A messianic era where we're all just going to be sitting and learning and connecting to God and the physical things that need to be done. Because it doesn't say that the food's just going to grow naturally, miraculously, but that's for the others to do it. You know, we're the princes, and those are the non-Jews will do it. Completely. And today, before the messianic era, there's no need for that. And not only is there no need for it, we shouldn't do it, because this is for us. To work the land, that's a messianic idea. The land to be worked is a messianic idea, and even then, we're not going to actually be working it. So he sees this as a complete distortion of the messianic notion, returning to the land. So really interesting, you know, this notion of the role of the non-Jews. There's a lot to say about this. I mean, I'm not joking when I say that you find people whose attitude is, you find this even in sources, things like this, that the job of the non-Jews, we're talking how many billion, 7 billion or whatever we are at, I don't know the number now, the job of the non-Jews is basically to take care of us, to make sure our life is better. You know, the Maharal, the Golem, the fear was they had to turn the golem off because then he'd kill all the goyim and then we're not going to have any Shabbos goyim. You know, so it's a very different, unusual, I think, from our perspective, way of looking at things. Okay, let's continue. Incidentally, I forgot to mention here, I want to show you another picture of Rav Oliver. Here's a picture from Odessa, yeah, Zionist group, and Rav Molliver is right in the middle there. Let me stop sharing this and go back to our screen. I want to raise an interesting question for you now, though. This idea of irreligious, where the Shinover says, absolutely not. We cannot have irreligious go into the land of Israel. It's metame the land. And we already saw Rav Molliver saying the opposite. And we saw the Yalkut Shimoni. The Yalkut Shimoni, I'll read you the Yalkut Shimoni again to refresh your memory. Yalkut Shimoni says, Anecha. And he quotes a pasuk that God says it would be great if only the Jews would live in Eretz Yisrael, even though they make it impure. Okay, so that would seem to be a clear proof that the irreligious should live in Eretz Yisrael. And I think today, when we look around, leaving aside the issues I'm going to speak about, just from a purely like utilitarian standpoint, if you have an irreligious Jew in Chutz La'aretz, they're going to intermarry. And within 2 generations, there'll be nothing left for most of them, as we see. But in Israel, even if they're irreligious, they're going to marry Jewish. Mean, this was a big issue when the Russians started coming out. I was in elementary school in the 70s when the first Jews were let out of the Soviet Union, and a number of them came to my elementary school. Hebrew Youth Academy of Essex County was called. Today it's called the Kushner School, but then it was called Hebrew Youth Academy. It began, founded in 1948, and then it was, at the time, it was in South Orange, New Jersey. And we started getting these Russian students. Federation obviously was paying for it. Now, why did they come to America? And by the way, they only lasted a couple of years. And next thing you know, I didn't have any in high school, and I didn't have any really in 7th or 8th grade. It was only they came for a year or two, and next thing you know, they were out and they were in public school. There was a big dispute between Israel and the federations. These Jews would come out, they'd go to Vienna. That was like the big stopping place. There were some others. The standpoint of the state of Israel was that all these Jews should come to Israel. That and the but the federations in America said that we can't tell people where to go. They'll have the option. And many people were saying, wait a second, we're not telling them where to go, but we don't have to provide them with money. If it's our money that's doing it, why should we bring them to America? And the claim was made that, you're going to take Russian Jews. If they want to come to America, fine, but for us to put up the money to bring them to America, these are very secular people, these Russians, the majority of them are just going to assimilate. And I mean, they can do that if they want, but American Jewish money doesn't need to enable assimilation. The only place that, the whole point is they were persecuted for being Jewish. In Russia, the only place really they can remain Jewish, realistically, is in the state of Israel. So this was an argument, and the position was in the end that if they want to come to America, they'll be helped to come to America. You can argue about it now. We're talking 2 generations later. Or was it good or bad? Because the fact is that most of these Russian Jews who came out did end up assimilating, and how many of them are still even halachically Jewish, the descendants. But the halachic issue was a different issue, or the hashkafa issue. Should you have brought these to the? So fine, they won't assimilate in Israel. They'll marry other Jews, but these are irreligious Jews. Are you take, should you bring them to the land of Israel? And this was an issue that even came up prior to the immigration in the 1970s. And if you want to read about this, I highly recommend an article that appeared in the journal Hamayan from a few years ago, Tishrei, Tavshin Pei, by Rabbi Yaakov Zisberg. And the title of the article is that quote I just gave you from the Yalkut Shimoni. And it's the subtitle is Aliyah La'aretz V'Ishmirat Mitzvot, and he goes through the different arguments, the different claims made about this. So let me tell you about some of the what he brings, what he mentions here. I almost spoke yeshivish. I said, "Oh, what he brings down." He points out that this Yalkut Shimoni has been front and center for all the discussion. I mean, it's a very relatively new discussion. you know, should we encourage irreligious Jews to go to the land of Israel, you know, the palace of God? He didn't have irreligious Jews going on Aliyah, you know, before the end of the 19th century. But he says that this has been a dispute, and some have derived from the Sialkut Shimoni, that even people far from Torah mitzvah should be encouraged to go to Eretz Yisrael. And others have thought just the opposite, that you can, so how could you think just the opposite? I'll show you how they read it. Let me just briefly tell you what some of the things he points out here. And he goes through the different sources. Okay. Now, if you have the Sialkut Shimoni, how could anyone be opposed to it? Well, the Satmar Rebbe was opposed to it. The Satmar Rebbe had the same approach of the Shinever. And so what do you do with this passage in the Yalkut Shimoni? Again, the Yalkut Shimoni says, would that my children, as the Jewish people, come to the land of Israel, be in the land of Israel, even though they are Matame, the land of Israel. The Satmar Rebbe says, this is what it means. It doesn't mean that the irreligious Jews should come, and that God is saying, I want the irreligious Jews here, even though they're Matame Eretz Yisrael. He says that this whole point of this Midrash is to strengthen the pious Jews who are worried that they do Averos, they speak Lashon Hara, or maybe they're not so makpid on certain things, but they're pious Jews. Even the people in Williamsburg sin sometimes, that they're going to be afraid. Satmar Hasidim are going to be afraid of going to live in Eretz Yisrael. Remember, there's nothing wrong with going just to live in the Kollel system there, like they used to have. We're not talking about creating settlements or colonies, but pious people will be afraid, he says, to go live in Eretz Yisrael because they think that they have sins. So therefore, Yalkut Shimoni is saying to them, don't worry about it, because even if you sin, God still wants you here. But the Satmar Rebbe says he's speaking about pious Jews who have sins. He's not speaking about heretics. He's not speaking about Mechalei Shabbos. For those, and by this answers the Sira, according to him. Rav Moliver has to explain then, what about the idea that the land will spit out those who are not religious? So you can have different approaches to that. What does it mean, those who are not religious? I mean, if you're an idolater in the land of Israel, then the land will spit you out. But if you don't know any better, if you recognize the value of the land of Israel, but you're a Mechal Shabbos, so that's, you can come up with all sorts of explanations. So that's what the Satmar Rebbe explains, that it's Chas V'Sholom to think, because that it's referring to sinners. But ain't Tzadik Ba'aretz, there's no Tzadik even who doesn't sin. So these are people who should not think that they don't go to the land of Israel. That's one approach. There's another approach he mentions, that if someone is in Eretz Yisrael and he's sinning, such a person should remain in Eretz Yisrael, because the holiness of Eretz Yisrael hopefully will bring him back. That is, he shouldn't leave Eretz Yisrael. But if you're in Chutz Laaretz and you're sinning, you shouldn't go to Eretz Yisrael. That is the verse or the saying in Yalkut Shimoni is only referring to people who are already in Eretz Yisrael. Okay, that's another interpretation. You have different interpretations. But let me now tell you about the psak of Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank. And we know about this because of this individual. His name is Shlomo Zalman Shragai. Shlomo Zalman Shragai, an author, a Talmud Chacham, a Radziner Chosid from his youth, although he became a Zionist. He was the mayor of Jerusalem, believe it or not, from 1915 to 1952. This religious Jew who had a very long life was the mayor of Jerusalem. His son is Nadav Shragai. He's a columnist for one of the newspapers. He's very much involved in Torah V'Avodah. So he was one of the leaders early in the state. He was a big Mizrahi person involved in this. He was the head of the Jewish agency, the section of Aliyah, from 1954 to 1968. So, and he was the one who arranged the great Aliyah from North Africa. We're talking Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria. Now, you had obviously religious Jews there, many religious Jews from the villages. But you also had from the cities many Jews who were not religious. We're talking in total about 500,000 Jews who they wanted to bring. And by the way, there were some who opposed in Israel who didn't want to bring them. They thought they were too backwards, things like that. So Shlomo Zalman Shragai records the situation and his discussion with Tzvi Pesach Frank. And he says as follows. He says that when we were going to bring these people to the land, to Eretz Yisrael, many of the Jews in Morocco, in Tunisia, and certainly in Algeria were not religious. They were not that religious. They were traditional Sephardic Jews, many of them, but some of them were even had become quite assimilated, especially in Algeria. And he tells us that there were those in Agudas Yisrael circles and just regular religious Jews who didn't want to bring these people to Eretz Yisrael because they thought it would be a bad influence, a very bad influence on the they would come and they would well, he says both things, that they would influence people negatively in the land of Israel, and also there was a fear that the young people, they would be negatively influenced by the environment in the land of Israel. That is, so religious Jews from Morocco, you don't want to bring them because they'll be negatively influenced. And the irreligious, you don't want to bring them because they're going to themselves be a bad influence. He points out that there was something to worry, that when these people who came on Aliyah, the people who ran the Israeli government, they put them in places where there wasn't kosher food and there were... It was not a good situation. Actually, take that back. No, he's saying he only mentions the. Let's see. No, first he begins by talking about bring Jews who are religious because they're going to be turned non-religious, and he says that happened many of them, and then he says, okay, I take back what I said. No, it wasn't that. He speaks earlier in this article about the irreligious Jews, but now he's speaking about the religious Jews. So the question is, you're going to bring these people to Israel. And he is saying 100% he feels many of them are going to become irreligious because the environment in Israel is going to be irreligious and they'll be made turned irreligious. He says, on the other hand, we know that there was a matter of life, a danger. He says, sakanat chayim for Jews in these countries. And we have to take them out. So the question is, do we bring them to Israel, where there's a good chance that, especially among the young, at this situation, he says the Mapai was pushing them into places where they would be in a non-religious environment, not kosher food or Shabbos, etc. So do we bring them to Israel, knowing we have to get them out because it's dangerous there, but we bring them here, they can become irreligious. Maybe they can go to France. It won't be so bad. Or maybe leave them in Morocco. Because, yeah, there's a danger to life, perhaps. There could be pogroms. But look, realistically, it's a small danger. You know, you might have some pogrom here or there or something like that. But at the end of the day, you're dealing with 250,000 Jews. You remove them, put them in an irreligious environment. You know, the danger to the soul could be worse than danger to the body. And he says that even among the Poel Mizrahi, you had people who thought it was dangerous to bring them here. So he says as follows. He says, I went to Ritzi Pesach Frank, and I explained the situation for him. I said that it's, you know, what's going to be? We bring them here. I'm going to take responsibility. They'll become irreligious. Ritzi Pesach Frank said to him, bring me the Yalkut Shimoni. He pointed to it. He had it in there. And he pointed to this passage in the Yalkut Shimoni that would that my children be in the land of Israel, even though they make a tummy. And this is the name of Reb Chiya. So Ritzi Pesach Frank says, what do you want from me? That I should disagree with Reb Chiya? That I should tell you to do the opposite of Reb Chiya from what God, he says God wants us to do? And he says, especially if they remain in Morocco, not only is there a sakana, a danger to their life, but there could also be a danger of assimilation. They could, you know, there was assimilation. There was assimilation into French society. And he says, therefore, you need to bring them up to Eretz Yisrael. He says, the Gemara has this expression, don't be concerned. The Hadei Kifshi Rachmana, you know, don't question what's going to be in the future. That's for God to know. You just have to bring them up and rely on the fact that God wants them here, even if they're irreligious. So based on that, he says they went ahead with this. Okay, well, we'll stop here. I thought there was one more point I wanted to make mention to you, but okay, we'll stop here. And I think today, I'll just end by saying that I think today, I haven't heard among the Haredi world any. Look, there was opposition to bringing the Russian Jews recently because so many of them were non-Jews. They said to you, but the argument was, don't just bring over all these Russians. You have to determine if they're Jewish or not. But I've not, to my knowledge, I haven't heard anyone in the Haredi world ever make the claim in recent years that we should not bring over people. We shouldn't make an effort to bring people over to Israel if they're not religious. On the contrary, when the Iron Curtain fell, they were very involved in bringing over Jews from Russia, because the idea is that you bring them over, at least now we have a chance to be Makari of them. If they remain in Russia, forget it. But you see, that wasn't always the case. And there was this notion that not that long ago that you don't want to bring these people over because they could become, if they're religious, they become irreligious. And if they're religious, and if they're not religious, you don't want to be metame the land with them. So I don't think, text me or email me if anyone knows, have anyone heard any expressions differently, that it's a problem. We brought over all these Russian Jews. Yeah, granted, some of them eat pork and things like that, but at least I haven't seen, and I read the Haredi literature, I haven't seen any opposition or anyone saying that it was a terrible thing that the state of Israel brought over these Russian Jews. The stress is always on the fact that they brought over non-Jews as well, but I could be wrong, but that's what I know. Let's see, questions here. I didn't say the one who corrected my pronunciation. I thought I said Eloah. I don't think I said, I didn't say Eloah. There's no ach there. Eloah. It's either, as I said last class, the Masoretes say there's two ways to pronounce it. It's either with a W, Eloah, or it's just Eloah. So either one is okay. If you looked at my blog post today, what I told you last week about how to pronounce these words like Sameach, Reach, I have a footnote. That's why it was on my mind last week when I mentioned it, because I had just written that footnote, but you can see there as well. So I believe I pronounced it correctly. Yes, so someone privately sends me when the Rambam at the Pre-Matan Torah in the Parish of Mishnah, it's in Chulin, he's actually dealing with the prohibition of Gid HaNasha. Gershom, you say, if Ben Sora or Mora is Noachide, is it as pre-Sinaitic as Gid HaNasha? No, well, first of all, the whole idea of Noachide laws, if you look at the Rambam in Hilchos Malachim, he makes it very clear. It's the idea that these laws were commanded to Moshe. Yes, before Moshe, they had to observe this, but once Matan Torah comes, this is reaffirmed. And the Rambam writes in Hochas Malachim that you have to believe that this is Mosaic. Now, what I spoke about, Rabbi Naor spoke about, that the Ben Sora Mora, then certain ways he's judged like in accordance with the Noahide law, that's just a way how the Torah looks at him. But no, it's not pre-Matan Torah. There's no Ben Sora Mora before that. Rabbi Yellen, it was reported in the Jerusalem Post that part of the reason Yitzhak Yosef made the statement he did regarding from people not reporting to the IDF, he said because his father's brothers all went into the army and became secular. Look, it's true. On our Morocco trip, Rafi, our wonderful tour guide, I mean, he goes off. Every time we do it, he starts speaking about his family, how they went to Israel and they became irreligious. It happened. We can't deny that it happened. And yet, Emirat Pesach Frank knew that that was a good chance it could happen. But he thought that, first of all, there's a danger in Morocco. And the Al-Quds Shimoni says, this is what you do. And as he explained, we don't concern ourselves what might happen. This is what God wants us to do. He wants us to live in the land of Israel. If bad things happen, okay, it happened, but we didn't know that at the time. So therefore, you do what you're supposed to do. And if it happens, others would, of course, disagree. And I mentioned it before that we heard those who were with me. Rabbi Yellen was one of those when we were in Gerba on Shabbos a couple of years ago, and one of the local rabbis came and he explained why they don't go to Israel, the young people. And he said, because they're afraid of, they've seen what happened. Many of the people from Gerba went to Israel after 48 and became irreligious. Today it's different in the army, though. When Vadya's siblings went into the army, like the late 40s, early 50s, the army was completely secular. Now the chief of staff is a Shomer Shabbos, and religious Jews are in the army. It's a very, very different army. I mean, you can't compare what it is today to what it was. But I acknowledge without any hesitation, I understand the Haredi position in that it would be hard to remain a Haredi the way they understand it and go through the army, even in Haredi units, because they would be just as religious in terms of Shabbos and Kashrus and Sneas and all these things, but they would not have a Haredi mentality, more of a sectarian mentality. There's no question to my mind that that would be broken down, and that's the reason why they don't want them to go, because they think the society as they've constructed it would be changed. And I have to agree that it would be changed. Now, I happen to think that would be a good thing if it would be changed, but that's, I'm not the Das Torah making that decision. Gershon says living in Eretz Yisrael enables a Jew to play in the Premier League. Yes, of course. Eretz Yisrael is the place that Jews are supposed to live in. There you are, Rabbi Allen. Yes, you said it exactly, and you heard it. And look, I get it. I wouldn't, if I thought my kids would become irreligious, I wouldn't want them to go to Israel. With all due respect to Rav Molivher and the Elkut Shimoni, that's and I think that position is the mainstream position, with all due respect to Rav Pesach Frank. I think many people were afraid to send their kids to Israel because of what it was in those years, in the 50s and the 60s. Today, of course, it's very, very different. I cannot imagine anyone going to Israel will become irreligious because they go to Israel. But the Gerba case is different because, in Gerba, you have Torah Jews. That's it, Torah Jews. And the other society is the Arab society. So you're not going to be part of that. If you go to Israel, you have a different society, you have the Masorati society. You have the, it's very easy for a Sephardic Jew to then become a Masorati type or less religious because there's a different society. In Gerba, there's only one society. So everyone there is a Torah Jew. There's no other option. So I understand it. The Yalkut Shimoni is on, well, the Hafa is on Kasubos. What is it? It's in Kuf Yud Amad Beis, and the Yalkut Shimoni is, I'll give you the exact reference here. It's in Yalkut Shimoni Eicha, section 1038. They call it Remez. They don't call it Siman or anything, but that you can find it there. And like I said, everyone has to deal with this Yalkut Shimoni, and the Satmar Rebbe knew the Yalkut Shimoni very well, and I already told you what he said. So, and lots of people share the Satmar Rebbe's basic position on this. Remember, it says the Yalkut Shimoni says, "Would that the children of my nation live here and be metamei the land." If you let's say you have the Satmar Rebbe's position, you'd say that the Machal Shabbos, an Ochel Neveros and Trefos, that's not one of the children of my people. They've already left the Jewish people. They're basically like, although technically they're Jewish, but they don't have the status of Jewish. You could say that you don't have to save them on Shabbos, and they touch your wine, it's no good. I mean, you can come up with all these reasons to say that these people are really michutz l'machaneh. So therefore, if you look at it from that perspective, Then, of course, when God speaks about his children, he's speaking about his children who are in the fold, who sin. He's not speaking about people who are apikorsim because they're already out of the fold. I don't. That might be pshat, really. That might be pshat in the Yalkut Shimoni. I like what Rav Moliver says, but the pshat might be like the Satmar Rebbe says. We're not speaking about people out of the fold because they're not part of Kol Yisrael the way we normally understand it. Okay, thank you very much, Rabbi Kelman.
I don't know. I don't want to get into the whole discussion. I'm no expert, but unfortunately, there are people from America that go to Israel and they become less religious for all kinds of reasons. Often, people with teenagers. It's a very difficult time to make Aliyah when you have teenagers.
Okay, interesting.
And a lot of the, I mean, I know for, people who told me, I know, you know, whatever, in certain communities, I don't want to start whatever, mentioning anything, but it is a problem. I also think there's a secondary problem, I call it like the Noah problem, like kind of you were alluding to. I don't think we're so religious in Israel, you know, in Chutzlar, some people might say, I'm not that, many people become more religious, I'm not saying that, but many people say, you know, and I live in Canada, the United States, I've got to really, you know, I keep my Judaism religious-wise. But in Israel, I don't have to, my religion, you know, I live in Israel. Just like a lot of Israelis who come here become, some assimilate, and some become actually more observant.
And, you know, I want to take back what I said, because the more I think about it, you know, I sort of poo-pooed it maybe. When you go as an adult, there's no, you won't become irreligious. Right. In fact, you'll be raised in your
life. That's when you're going, when you're
retirement. But I'm thinking of people I know. You go, let's say you take a kid who's 13, 14 years old. If they'd stay in America, they'd be in day school. Then they go to university. In university, they'd be in a Jewish environment probably, even if it's secular university, many of them. You go to the army. You're really now with a lot of the religious. Many
it's
people
not just the army. They come at 14. Their Hebrew isn't perfect, and it's hard to adjust. Not everybody. Yeah. Some adjust very well, but not everybody adjust well. There, I know there are rabbis who tell people not to make aliyah with teenage kids, even in the Zionist world. Like that's not a make aliyah when your kids are young or older.
Yeah. Nice. Okay. Very interesting.
Anyways, it's a complicated thing, but all right. Okay, thank you. Like I mentioned earlier, next Monday night there is no class, but next Tuesday night, Mark will be speaking on Hinduism and Judaism as we kick off. Well, he's actually our second speaker. We're going to kick off at 8 o'clock next Tuesday night, December 24th, otherwise known as Christmas Eve in some circles. But Rabbi Dr. Moshe Miller will be speaking on Shimshon Raphael Hirsch's attitude towards Christianity and non-Jews. And then on Wednesday from 9:15 till after 2, we'll be having a series of speakers on Hanukkah on December 25th, a combination of topics. Sefer Maccabim, all kinds of interesting topics. We did send out the email, so that'll be, and it will require a separate registration, like our Yemei Yun. This registration link won't work for that. So anyway, that's just telling you next week. So Dr. Mark will be speaking next Tuesday night at 8:45, a little bit later, because we're going to start at 8. We're going to give a 45-minute talk, and then we'll continue. Okay. Laila Tov tomorrow, Rabbi Shulman, this class on Yoshua, and then all the regular classes during the week. And we look forward to learning with you, and everybody be well. And thank you very much. Laila Tov.